Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for braving the heat to come over here. It's quite the brutal temperature for today, but I'm of course delighted to see so many of you and of course know so many of you and work with you day to day as we all work together to try to advance our common goal of improving the Freedom of Information Act. And my name is Melanie Paste, the director of the Office of Information Policy at the Department of Justice. And as you, certainly all the Chief FOIA officers here know, the job of the Department of Justice, which OIP handles, is to carry out the responsibilities of the Attorney General under the FOIA. And we kind of collectively consider those duties to be encouraging and overseeing compliance with the law. So we try to hit it for you in every conceivable, from every conceivable angle, every conceivable direction, looking for ways that we can move the ball forward in making the act work better for everyone. You all know, too, that the Attorney General in the FOIA guidelines that he issued in 2009 specifically said that proper, efficient implementation of the FOIA requires the active participation of Chief FOIA officers. So we have always felt, long felt, that the real kind of, we have the heart of FOIA as the FOIA professionals, but the entity within the government that can really help us move forward with more programmatic changes, systemic changes to the law, is the Chief FOIA officer. So that's why we're delighted to have us all come together in what is now going to be a newly formed council of Chief FOIA officers so that we can share experiences across agencies and learn from one another. And yesterday at the, I heard this wonderful quote at the Federal Advisory Committee meeting. We all know the reason underlying the FOIA to help citizens be engaged in their government and know the activities and operations of their government. But yesterday I heard this wonderful quote from Winston Churchill that says, "The farther backward you can look, the farther forward you can see." And I just loved that, and it was a different perspective or a quote I had not seen associated with FOIA before, and I really loved it because it's yet another benefit, obviously, to this really important law that we just celebrated the 50th anniversary of. So one thing I wanted to do, obviously those of you here who are Chief FOIA officers, you know your responsibilities in that position. I put them here on this slide. We've had this, actually, the responsibilities of Chief FOIA officers actually codified in the FOIA since the 2007 amendments. And the idea, of course, is that the Chief FOIA officer is the senior level official in an agency, so the high level official, assistant secretary level or equivalent, that is responsible for overall administration of the law, making sure that funding, personnel, IT resources are available to help with the FOIA program. They also, Chief FOIA officers also obviously report to the, not only to their agency head, but the agency head in turn reports to the Department of Justice on the activities of the FOIA. And of course, because of that relationship, we've established the Chief FOIA officer reports, where every year we're learning and seeing lots of wonderful examples of steps that agencies are taking to improve FOIA. Now, what Congress just did with amending the FOIA in 2016 was put two new responsibilities in for Chief FOIA officers, but I think for most of you, these are already obviously something that you're already doing within your agency, but now it's just particularly associated with the Chief FOIA officer, and that's to offer training to agency personnel and to serve as the primary liaison with both OIP and the Office of Government Information Services. Also, the FOIA now has this requirement that Chief FOIA officers review all these specific aspects of their agency's FOIA operations, their regulations, their use of amendments, assessment of fees. Again, though, these are all part and parcel of all the areas in FOIA administration that Chief FOIA officers have long been looking into and been reporting on, since we had the advent of Chief FOIA officer reports. Now, what we're here today to inaugurate is our first meeting of us working together collectively as a Chief FOIA Officer Council. And this is also something that's now officially established by the FOIA itself. And the co-chairs of the council are the director of the Office of Information Policy at Justice, which currently is me, also the director of the Office of Government Information Services at NARA, and Nikki Gramian is the deputy director there and now the acting director. And then also a member of the council, the deputy director for management of OMB, who's Andrew Mayock, is part of the council. And then, of course, the makeup of the council is all of you as chief FOIA officers. So before we get into more specifically the duties of all of us as a council, I wanted to turn the microphone over to Andrew to say a few words.
Thank you, Melanie. And thank you, everybody here and live streaming, for the opportunity to say a few words about OMB's role in the council. And I just say, first and foremost, it's as my boss, the director Sean Donovan, said yesterday, put an emphasis on what an important piece this is to the Obama administration from the very beginning, with an emphasis on transparency, and this law really being a culmination as this administration comes to a close as to the importance of this important tool. There's three basic ways that OMB is going to interact and engage with the council, three primary ways, and I wanted to share those with you. I think folks are probably familiar with this from the announcements around the law, but I will briefly highlight them. One is by January 1st, we will work with this council, and in particular DOJ, to help develop guidance to regarding a release to one as a release to all presumptive standard. Two, we'll keep working with DOJ and others to launch a consolidated request portal. So continue efforts on that. Make sure that gets accomplished. And third, which we also announced along with the law, the creation of this, of FOIA as a cross-agency priority goal. So these CAP goals, which people might be less familiar with, are ways that we work together for cross-agency, cross-cutting priorities that are particularly difficult or particular priorities in order to drive performance. There's this will be the 16th of this administration, and others include, for example, open data, cybersecurity, STEM education, smarter IT, improving veterans' mental health, and infrastructure permitting. So we'll just give you an idea, basically where we need to bring a number of agencies together to really drive performance. Again, on a high priority issue, we make it a CAP goal. And what makes it particularly productive as a CAP goal are a number of things. One, we provide senior level leadership, so that we've got the right agencies that are accountable and report on a regular basis. So in this case, the co-goal leaders will be OMB, DOJ, and NARA. Two, we'll develop a four-year time frame. That by statute is the length of a CAP goal. As part of that, we'll develop a detailed action plan with metrics and milestones, and then those metrics and milestones get reported every quarter on performance.gov, so there's a transparency aspect to this to make sure that we're doing our jobs when we identify these few cross-agency priorities goals that we're making progress, or when we're not making progress, that also gets noted too. Yes, we are going to make a lot of progress. In the near term, what we're really seeking to do from the CAP goal perspective is make sure that we drive implementation on the recently passed law. In the longer term, I want to work with everybody here in the council and with the CAP goal leaders to make sure that we work hard to make sure we get on top of and stay on top of the serious challenges that there are and really effectuating this law best and better. We've already started working with DOJ and NARA and OSTP to make sure we get this off the ground. So we look forward to that. We look forward to further council meetings to report on progress, and we look forward to working with everybody here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And
now I'd like to introduce Nikki Gramian, who's the acting director of OGIS, Office of Government Information Services, OGIS, at NARA.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, thank you all for being here today, and thank you, Melanie, and the OIP staff for organizing this event on such a short notice. I know how much work that is. I'm Nikki Gramian, the Deputy Director of the Office of Government Information Services, known as OGIS, at the National Archives and Records Administration. I will be co-chairing these meetings until the vacancy of the OGIS Director's position is filled, and hopefully soon. And for those of you who are not familiar with OGIS, we were created by the Open Government Act of 2007 to provide mediation services to resolve FOIA disputes, review agency compliance with FOIA, and recommend improvement to the FOIA process. The most recent amendments to FOIA significantly expanded our role in mediating FOIA disputes between agencies and requesters, directed OGIS to identify ways to improve agency compliance with FOIA, and strengthened our unique role in improving the FOIA process. As Chief FOIA Officers, as you all heard from Melanie, you all have the agency-wide responsibility for efficient and appropriate compliance with FOIA, as well as recommending adjustments to agency FOIA practices, policies, personnel, and funding. Those statutory mandates dovetail with our statutory mandate to review agency FOIA compliance. These mandates present an opportunity for our offices to work closely together, and we look forward to that opportunity. As you all might know, the amendments to the FOIA also created new annual reporting requirements that agencies submit their annual reports to OIP as well as OGIS. We will be contacting you this summer to provide additional information about the submission of these reports to our office or any additional reporting requirements created by the FOIA amendments. In addition to serving as the co-chair for this group, OGIS also leads the FOIA Advisory Committee, which brings together requesters and agency FOIA professionals to recommend improvement to the administration of FOIA process. For background, the U.S. Second Open Government National Action Plan contained an initiative to modernize the FOIA. One of the goals was to establish a FOIA Modernization Advisory Committee. The National Archives and Records Administration launched the FOIA Advisory Committee in 2014 to meet the administration's goal for creation of this advisory committee. OGIS provides leadership and administrative support for the advisory committee. The members of the FOIA Advisory Committee, comprised of government and non-government members of the FOIA community, have decades of experience with FOIA. The first term of the FOIA Advisory Committee ended up on a high note in April of this year. During its last meeting, committee members collaborated to develop a unanimously passed recommendation to improve the FOIA fees guidelines. The Archivist of the United States renewed the term for this committee for another 2 years, and the 2016-18 term began with his first public meeting yesterday. During this term, the committee will have a unique opportunity to look more broadly at the challenges of meeting the public's request for records in the face of an ever-increasing volume of electronic records, and chart a course for how FOIA should operate in the face of those challenges. During yesterday's meeting, the committee members began identifying issues they will work on over the next 2 years. When asked to name the hardest issues in the FOIA for committee deliberation, the members pointed to issues with funding, technology, the ever-increasing volume of records and requests, and awareness or commitment of agency officials to FOIA. The committee also spoke about the need to increase proactive disclosure and the current impediments agencies face to making more information available without the need to file FOIA. In preparation for our next meeting, we have asked committee members to think about which of these issues hold the greatest area of opportunity and where the committee can make its greatest contribution. During our October meeting, the committee will be forming subcommittees to address some of these topics. The committee's membership and additional information is available on our website at www.ogis.org.
www.archives.gov. We believe the advisory committee and this council complement one another, and we will make sure that the two bodies are apprised of each other's work. I'm happy to provide you with additional information about the committee's schedule and the standard agenda if you would like to alert your FOIA officers of these meetings. And I look forward to telling you more about the advisory committee's progress during the future council meetings. Thank you all again for being here today, and OGIS looks forward to working with you all to improve compliance and efficiency of the FOIA process.
Thank you. So, at one of the things, if you look at the third bullet, are those drapes blocking people's view of the slides? Are you all right? I can do it. Okay. The third bullet of the slides, the duties of the council, which are now set out in the FOIA statute itself. If you look at the third bullet, one of the things that and that I think is just a natural thing for us to do as a council is to help develop and coordinate initiatives to advance transparency. And what we have already is our first initiative for us to discuss as a council, and that's the our recently completed release to one, release to all policy. As you know, when President Obama signed the FOIA Improvement Act of 2016, he specifically directed that this newly created Chief FOIA Officers Council look at the release to one, release to all policy with the idea of how can we implement this? How can we implement this policy broadly across the government by January of 2017? So we have a short time period, and it's but we have a nice concrete initiative to advance transparency on the table for us right away to consider. So what I first wanted to do is walk you through a little bit what happened with our pilot and how we got to where we are now. So, of course, the President's memorandum on the FOIA and the Department of Justice's FOIA guidelines both talked about the importance of transparency. So, from the beginning in 2009, we've all been working as agencies, and we've all certainly been very aware and working hard to increase proactive disclosures. In your Chief FOIA Officer reports every year, my office has asked agencies to report on activities that you all are doing in relation to proactive disclosure. So not just different things that you're posting, but also steps you're taking to make information more usable, retrievable by the public. And we've had a lot of tremendous progress in this area, a lot of really interesting things that agencies are posting. We listed just a couple of the things on the slides to give you a sense of just the incredible range of documents and information that agencies are posting across the government. Everything ranging from the Ebola outbreak to automobile safety, food safety, energy resources, you name it. Obviously, all agencies are doing lots of different things, really important work in making proactive disclosures related to that work. Then we certainly, as part of our FOIA responsibilities within OIP in 2015, we put yet additional emphasis on the importance of proactive disclosure and issued comprehensive guidance on the statutory requirements that we have in the FOIA to release specific types of records, including frequently requested records. So the FOIA has had for quite a while, since I think the 90s, a requirement that when a popular topic is requested and gets requested more than two, what we've interpreted it to mean a total of three times, and we just call that frequently requested. There's been long been a requirement in the FOIA that frequently requested records are to be posted on an agency website. The whole idea there is, by virtue of the fact that you're getting multiple requests for the same records, that's your trigger that the public is interested. So satisfy that demand for that information by posting. Congress just recently in the 2016 FOIA amendments codified that DOJ, what we call the rule of three. The idea is now, instead of just being our guidance, it's now a requirement that once you get three requests, they have to be posted online. But so as a logical sort of next step behind all of that, or next step along this path, we wanted to explore the idea not just of posting frequently requested records, or not just disclosing records when there's the BP oil spill and big topics that agencies necessarily sort of marshal their resources and post material. A logical sort of extension of all this work was to say, what about just posting every FOIA release? And when you think about it, of course, the FOIA requester can post the information, can disseminate the information, and obviously lots of requesters do that. We have this long-standing FOIA maxim, release to one is release to all, which is what gave us the name of our pilot. And that's that legally, when agencies are processing records for release, they're looking at the release as if it is to be a public release. So that's part of the analysis that goes into preparing the document for release or analyzing it for release. So why not make it literally true? So that was the premise, and kind of that's the background, what led us up to where we were to launch the pilot. So in July of 2015, with sort of seven brave volunteer agencies, we launched a six-month pilot to really test the feasibility and find out pragmatically how we could actually go about posting every FOIA request. Not waiting till there's three, but posting each one. Now, first, yeah, I keep saying every, and actually I have to catch myself, but I know I have this huge caveat, but so let me make sure you all see. A huge caveat to this was that, of course, we were not posting requests when people asked for their own records. So what we call first-party requests, when you ask for your own records, of course, those are not even remotely considered for our posting on the internet, so that we carve those out right from the get-go. And the reason, the other sort of big caveat or big sort of factor that went into having a pilot was that we knew at OIP from our working with agencies that there are time and resources that are needed to prepare documents for posting, to make sure that they're accessible to everyone. And those time and resources are something that has to be factored in. We knew that going in, and that was part another part of the reason why we wanted to have a pilot where we could actually collect some metrics and see pragmatically and realistically how difficult those the actual mechanics of posting would be. So here are our participants to the pilot. We have many of them here. DOD gave us eight components, which was a really wonderful, strong showing by DOD. Department of Homeland Security had some initial participation in our pilot. Millennium Challenge Corporation also participated. The ODNI, which we were very happy to have them participate. You can see we had a really nice range of types of agencies who participated. EPA, which had already adopted a policy of releasing one to release to all, joined our pilot to help to share their perspectives. We also had the Office of General Counsel from NAR, from the National Archives, and then we had a component of Office of Justice Programs within DOJ as participants. So I am always never want to miss an opportunity to thank those agencies who participated in the pilot, because it was work for people, but I really appreciated it because it's what gave us the metrics that we have now. So. We knew that some of the things that we wanted to answer through the course of the pilot were things like the costs associated with posting, more broadly posting, the impact on staff time. We also wanted to see, did this spending time posting detract from times processing other FOIA requests? That was obviously a logical issue. We also wanted to see if there was any effect on interactions with other stakeholders. And then lastly, we wanted to see if there were any other need for exceptions to the policy, in addition to the one that we already knew going in about excluding first-party requests. So we had a six-month period where our participants plunged in and started doing this posting. And along the way, they shared metrics with us. We gave guidance. We answered questions. Then at the end of the 6 months, we did what we called sort of exit interviews with all the participants to gather more information. And then we put together an analysis of all the data. And we created an assessment of the pilot, which we did post on our website. And so obviously that's something that I want to refer you all to for a real thorough description of the pilot. But what I want to do today for the benefit of us, our work here, is to go over the findings that came out of the pilot. And first and foremost, we saw during the course of the pilot that leadership buy-in was absolutely essential. You need to have leadership from the top to help make sure that this is the policy was a priority, that resources were being devoted to it, helping facilitate connections between different offices that was a necessary part of implementing this policy. I think the wonderful thing for us now is that we have terrific leadership buy-in, the president himself directing us all to come up with a policy for implementing this broadly across the government by January. So we've got the highest leadership that we could hope for in terms of advancing this. But again, within the agencies, there's no substitute for the role of the chief FOIA officer to really make this work on the ground. Second thing that we found was that no surprise that the only way this works is that the agency has to have a plan to address accessibility issues, which we sort of refer to shorthand by calling them 508, because it's Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act that imposes requirements on agencies to make sure that when they post material, it's accessible to everyone. So the things that that are going to be essential for chief FOIA officers is looking at the volume of material to be posted. Certainly, even within our small pilot, there was a big difference between those offices that had a smaller volume of material, obviously much easier and less time-consuming to post that, than the offices that had a higher volume of material. So we know going in that at different agencies, the level of effort and the level of resources needed is going to vary widely depending on how many FOIA responses you actually have in your bucket to post. And then also, obviously, it's necessary to have a plan for deciding who's going to be doing the job of 508. One thing we did to sort of help our process of our analysis was for our 2016 Chief FOIA Officer reports, we asked everybody to tell us, does your FOIA office have any role in preparing documents for posting? So is there any role at all? And that could range from just answering questions from the IT shop, or actually, is the FOIA office the ones doing the work to prepare the documents for posting? We learned from that survey, from the Chief FOIA Officer reports, that 24 agencies had at least some involvement of their FOIA office in posting. So there's sort of two sides of that. In one sense, if I look at it strictly from the FOIA office point of view, I'm happy that there are 76 FOIA offices who don't have to worry about resources and technology for posting. And those 70, at least right at this moment, those 76 offices, the FOIA office will not be encumbered by this policy. But of course, that means those agencies, IT offices, their web shops will be absorbing the work needed to do this posting, which again is why we need the involvement of the chief FOIA officer. And then obviously the flipping the coin the other way, we still do have at least 24 FOIA offices who themselves work in some capacity on posting, which does mean that we have to factor in for those offices the impact on FOIA processing to mitigate and minimize as much as we can the impact on other requests that are coming in. So the answer to this is going to be different for each agency depending on where you put your resources for coding. We did also find that we do in fact need to be flexible and have exceptions to the policy. We had excluded first party requests, but even in our small, relatively small universe during our pilot, we did have a couple of examples of material. We had a graphic video of a car accident that the agency just said, this just doesn't feel right to put that up on the internet. It made sense to us. We also had an office that had really difficult documents to code. They were web fillable forms that are apparently really particularly difficult to code for posting. And again, it made sense to have some flexibility to say that type of document could be excluded from the requirement to post. So we do think it's important to have some flexibility and some exceptions. Now, we were hoping to see some impact on number of FOIA requests or number of visits to the website, but the data that we got was just, we couldn't draw any conclusions from it. It was all over the board. For some offices, they had more FOIA requests, other offices had less, and same with visits to their website. So you couldn't really draw a direct conclusion. But it does lead us to our next finding, which is that we really believe that there is just an inherent value in posting FOIA releases online so that they are available to all. And we think that even if there's one one requester who can find the records they want by looking online and not having to make a request. That's one requester that gets their documents easier and faster. And that's one less request that the agency has to handle. So I think that there is this what we're calling inherent value to doing this. And also, we think that there are real strong parallels that can be drawn between this effort and the efforts that we've made in the open data space, where at first people didn't really know how valuable, how useful is it going to be to post this data on weather or on energy emissions. And, you know, when you look now at data.gov and see all the tremendous things that are there and how it's used across the government, I think there could be a lot of parallels with FOIA releases, that once this gets going and once we have a large body of FOIA process documents and good searchability for it, because I do think, and that's certainly something that we're working on in conjunction with a consolidated portal, we really also think that it's important that you be able to find the records, because if the requesters can't easily find the processed records, they're going to still make the requests, and we won't have achieved anything in terms of efficiency. So the two things go hand in hand as far as we're concerned. But we do think that there, when you put that all together, that there is inherent value to this. The other thing that we found from this, from the pilot, was that there weren't, that none of the participants in the pilot had any reported any impact on outside stakeholders. They didn't have any problem. There was no issue in terms of how people interacted with the agency. But we certainly did, we at OIP did hear, and we saw obviously just in the just published press articles, journalists definitely did have, journalists what were a community that definitely did have some concerns. And it was interesting to read the articles because the concerns were mixed. Some of the journalists were concerned about losing their scoop, ability to have a scoop, or a fear that this would be a disincentive to using FOIA, and also to just work as an investigative journalist, to work to uncover facts, to build a story, that this would be a disincentive because why spend all that time and money to build a story if the results of the FOIA response are available immediately. At the same time, there were other journalists who said, well, wait a minute, it's taxpayer money, and these are public releases, and isn't it a little ironic for journalists to be saying they want less transparency? So there, it really was a mix. And there were certainly some journalists who posited the idea of at least a reasonable delay as kind of maybe a middle ground to accommodating everyone. So this, as we'll talk about in a minute, this is definitely an area that we want to gather more information about, because there really was a mix of reaction by journalists. And then lastly, we found that there were additional benefits, really sort of, you know, unintended benefits, things that we hadn't planned to study, but things that just came out as a result of this. And that's that the participants all really ended up saying that going through the process of creating the workflows and establishing this practice where they post their FOIA responses online, that it helped them develop working relationships with their IT folks. It made them more aware of other things that were being posted in the agencies. They found greater efficiencies working with other offices. So it was obviously really nice to see that there were some sort of efficiency and awareness issues that were a nice side benefit of implementing a release to all policy. So that brings us to, like, what do we all need to do here? The president, as part of his announcement in signing the FOIA Improvement Act, actually, you know, directed us as a council to look at how we pragmatically could implement a release to all presumption across the government, with the idea that we'll be issuing guidance on this by January. And I think that it's a perfect tasking for the council, because as you've been hearing me say, it's only you and your role as chief FOIA officer that you have that oversight, you have that higher view of your agency, and you are in a position to see how can you make this work. How can you allocate the resources? How can you adjust the workflows? How pragmatically can you make it work? And how much time do you think you need to stand it up? So the sort of steps that we envision you all taking to help us because the idea here is that we want to get your input, we want to get your feedback so that we have that as a basis for creating the policy guidance that will come out in January. We thought the very first thing we wanted all the Chief FOIA officers to do is really simply to just go back to your agencies and just take a good look at this. Okay, now that it is going to happen, what do you need to do to get ready for it? What do you need? And then to report, be ready to report back to us on what you would need, how much time you need, how feasible it will be at what given time period. What we will do in my office to make that easier for you all, or at least to help guide your thought process, is we'll put together a template that we can send out to the Chief FOIA officer so that that will also help facilitate you answering the things that we think you're going to need to look at. And then it'll also help us kind of compile what is the reaction collectively as agencies. I'm imagining that there are going to be some agencies that go back now, look at the pilot and say, you know, really within, we can stand it up within a month. It's just a matter now. We're going to do it. We're being asked to do it. It's here. I'm imagining some agencies are going to be able to say we can do it. We're already leaning toward do it. We're already doing it partway. We can do it full. So this will be our initial snapshot of like, what can you do? What are you doing now? And how could you implement it? One of the options that we have, of course, is a rolling implementation. That you agencies do this 25%. Within 6 months, 50%. Within, we have many different options, but I think first we all just have to go back and just look to see how can you do it. Sort of now it's a tasking. How can you do it? The second thing, of course, is that we have to address the issue of the journalist community. So what we will do is the next council meeting, what we will do is invite journalists to come and give their arguments in person. And certainly anybody, member of the public or journalist can give us comments on our release to all email. And we just like to have sort of a session where we can hear from the journalists and also hear from agencies your thoughts about building in a reasonable delay. We realize that for some agency, well, probably most agencies, to build in a delay will be an administrative step that either could be easy to do or it might not be as easy, and it's an extra step. You'll have to remember, I release it just to the requester, and then a week later I post it. It's an extra step, so it's there's an impact on agencies. So to the extent we can automate that, that makes that easier and less, but I think it's important to hear agencies' views on building in a delay as well. So that will be the subject of our next council meeting. And that basically is what leaves us with going forward. We're asking you all to do that assessment of what it would take at your end. We'll send you a template to help guide your answers back, and then we'll be scheduling a meeting to hear from journalists. So it's like we're right from the get-go, guys. We've got a lot of work to do as a council, but it's a very concrete thing. And I think, in a way, the fact that we have a time limit helps really focus, will help us all focus our efforts. And with that, I'm definitely going to open it for discussion because I'm imagining that the people might have some questions or comments. I'm happy to hear from anyone who does. Or maybe not. Yes, okay. Yes, actually, this would be another unintended benefit of this is that once we're releasing I'm excluding first parties, nearly all or requests, then we don't have to worry about frequently. We don't have to count our three. It eliminates, just takes that out of off the table. Right. I don't know if everyone can hear the comment, just that they know that making the documents compliant with 508 will be time consuming. And so, of course, that's why we're going to need everybody, all agencies, to assess sort of how they think they can best do this. Yes. Well, so that's, I mean, this is, those were the issues that we heard before we did the pilot. I mean, that's exactly the concerns people had. And that's why we did the pilot, to see, to really sort of document impact and timeliness on requests. And so when you look at our full assessment, you'll see that, and this to me is really kind of, is really the most telling thing of all. When we did our exit interviews of the participants, they all said they're going to keep going. And there were caveats. Some of the offices had caveats. Some said, "Well, we'll do it. We're going to keep going. We're going to do it gradually." But and certainly some said it'll be easier for us if we could have it be done in a certain way. But people were going to keep doing it, even after the pilot. So I think that a lot of this, I think what the pilot showed is that, part of the problem or part of the challenge is to figure out how best to do it and then go forward. And so this is why we want to hear from agencies, though, as to how you think you can do it. We can't, the premise now is that we will be issuing guidance to agency under the president's direction to do it. So I think right now what we all have to think about is how can we do it? And a chief FOIA officer, by law, is a person who has responsibility more broadly to make recommendations to their agency head. So as chief FOIA officers, if you need to go to your agency head to talk about interacting with your tech people, your IT people, each of our participants in the pilot had different interactions. It was very interesting. Some had real close relationships with the IT people and the FOIA office, and that's what made it work. Others had the posting responsibilities handled by someone outside the FOIA office, which meant there was no impact on FOIA processing. So I know it's really going to vary depending on how you decide as an agency to do it. Yes. Well, certainly my vision would not be that it would be applied retroactively. I think we're going to have so many challenges for agencies to do it going forward. But the idea here is that we're figuring out how the policy will look. So, but that's not my vision. I don't want you to be worried that we would say, now go back in time. It makes much more sense for me to go forward. Yes. The pilot did not attempt to answer that, because part of the reason for that is that every agency right now is posting material, and every agency has teams of people who are responsible for 508 compliant. So we did not attempt to try to routinize or simplify the 508 process, because that was really outside our jurisdiction. And this is a FOIA effort. And what we're talking about is adding something to a bucket of already existing documents that all agencies are posting. So we didn't want the concept of release to all to be slowed down by concerns with, well, how can we do different things with 508? That can happen independently, and I think there's always efforts underway to simplify that process. But this is the pilot was not an attempt to address that specifically. It's to let people use their existing 508 compliant schemes and systems, and just add documents to it. Yes, yeah, Cindy. Hi.
Yeah, I know. And the reason for that is that I come from an agency where we currently, we don't have anyone else doing this other than FOIA. And so for me, it's not a question mark. It's a certainty that if release to one, release for all goes live, that absolutely will impact, there's no question, that will impact the time period that everyone else gets things. The difference for that would be if there was some sort of, especially during this trial period, exception from 508 for these types of FOIA releases where we could have a disclaimer, which we sometimes do on a limited basis now, to say that, if you need something in a 508 compliant form, let us know and we'll work with you. For us, that would make a world of difference. But my question for you, Melanie, is of the agencies that volunteer to take part in your pilot, how many of those were like my agency, it was purely the FOIA folks doing the 508?
I don't think we didn't have anyone purely with the FOIA office, but certainly several of our pilot participants did a lot of the work of preparing the documents for 508. So we definitely had, at least a part of what you're talking about. I think that, though, your comments are exactly the kind of thing that we want to gather from all agencies. So my hope is that agencies could look at, and maybe here I should just put this out as what I would like to ask you all to do, what could you do immediately? And then, and this will be part of the template we design, but it seems to me like it's always helpful. And certainly this was borne out by the pilot. Once people started, it got easier and better. And then that's the proof is in the pudding, in that the participants want to keep going. So we would like to ask people what's the minimum you can do by January to get started, to get down this path? Because I think as you start, then you will find it gets easier. Yes.
Okay, so as a part of the pilot, my question is, did any of the agencies report on when information was posted and it had not gone through the appeal process, did any members of the public actually want to challenge any of the exemptions applied to the documents? Mm. How was that handled?
Yeah, we didn't look into that issue. But I've heard that issue before, and it seems to me agencies could address that in a number of ways. If you ended up on appeal, releasing more information, you could always just, as a matter of discretion, post that substitute that newly processed version for the version that's up there. So I don't really think it would be that difficult. But certainly, I think for our vision of this policy at the beginning, we wouldn't try to impose that as a requirement. I think what's important is to get going with posting the responses online, and then agencies can build out functionality like, well, we're going to always update after appeal, that kind of thing. Yes.
So I come from an economic-related agency. So in looking at things like this, I think we'd look at this pretty straightforwardly and saying the government wants two goods from us, right? They want more information to be posted,
right,
and they want information to be accessible to everyone.
Right.
It seems like it's incumbent then on policymakers to make a choice, as you would in any other situation. What's the trade-off between these two things? Do you want more information? Or do you want information to be acceptable, and I think accessible. I think if there were guidance on that for a given amount of resources, right? Nobody's getting more resources to do this. For a given amount of resources, it'd be great to know, would you like people to use those resources to make FOIA responses available quickly? Or would you like, you know, a slower pace of release of information and have it all 508 acceptable or readable? And right now, we're sort of stuck between these two aims. And you all are rightly pushing on the idea of making more available, but not giving any guidance on how we should use our resources for doing that fast without 508, mm-hmm. doing it slow with 508. Mm-hmm. You know, where would you like us to be?
Well, I think, so I have a couple responses to that. I think we saw through the pilot that there was a real range in terms of how much agencies that had more robust IT web teams and had better technology and newer records to deal with, that's also a piece of this, were able to post things very quickly. And so it didn't impact their FOIA processing and was minimally. And of course, those offices, that's the easiest scenario. Other offices had more difficulties. If the less you're able to use technology to help you make things 508 compliant, and the more labor intensive it is, obviously the harder it is. So there's definitely a range within agencies of their capabilities, and the age of their documents has an impact on it. I think that partly what we have here, though, is the opportunity as a group to weigh in on what are the concerns that you have, what is it that you could do in January, how much time would it take to make, what would you need, how much, you know, what would it take to get you all the way to the end of the line. And that's the kind of feedback that we're going to need from the agencies, because we can then fold that into or take that into account, obviously, in the guidance that we're going to be formulating for January.
So one suggestion there, I mean, I think that technology is a potential relief in this sort of conflict between these two things.
Right.
One of the things that we've done for other purposes is we have a pretty expensive and pretty fast OCR engine. Mm-hmm. That thing probably has a 10% utilization, right? It just sits idle a lot of the time.
Oh, wow.
If you had one or some other central agency had one,
right.
You could establish a folder, say, and that says, drop your PDFs in here, mm-hmm. and 15 minutes later they will pop out and they'll be 508 compliant.
Right.
There've got to be lots of small agencies who just don't have that capability.
Right.
You could provide those.
I think that's some of the ideas that we could have, and I think that's a terrific idea, and part some of the components within DOD that were part of our pilot mentioned the same thing, that if there could be a consolidated spot for them to, for the offices to send the documents for coding, that would make all the difference. So that's definitely something that we can look at and work with OMB to see if that's how feasible that is, how possible that is. To do something like that.
And then I think from an agency perspective, there would be a lot of value. I mean, one of the functions that a central place could provide would be, in addition to technology tools, mm-hmm. a prioritization. So an agency could say, hey, we have released this to one person. We think it's available. We've turned it over to this central place, mm-hmm. and would love to make it available to everybody. And when this organization can code it, it will be released, then that central place can say, wow, this is really important. We're going to prioritize this. And, yeah, we know people want this other thing, but it's just less important.
We do – these are all good points. I think I just wanted to make sure people realize that we've got 100 agencies. We have, just in 1 year alone, 700,000 FOIA requests. And we obviously operate FOIA on a decentralized basis. So I think that while we might love the idea of a big agency that we're just going to all send it, they're going to do all this stuff, I want us to be realistic here about what we can do.
Okay, so I've succeeded then in turning the tables.
You might be going too far because what I worry about is that when people think, oh, well, great, if you can just solve it for me by letting me send this stuff over here and it's some magical entity that's going to do all this, then that's not going to help us for our January deadline. So what I think, which is why I keep getting back to the idea, is my inclination, at least right now, is that we're going to want agencies to be able to do something by January. So I'd like to, you yourself, your agency, do something. Now, you can team with another agency if you want to, can make your own deal with another agency. But I think I'd like you all to think about it in terms of what can you do. And that's what we need you to report on, because otherwise we won't, we need to break through and get sort of get going. And certainly one of the approaches can be that it's a rolling thing. 1% of your FOIA requests get posted in the first 6 months. 2%, something like that. So I just would ask you for this initial looking in at what your capabilities, to be thinking about what could you do? What could you do? Okay, thanks. Yes, in the back.
Really a dedicated FOIA shop, forget about a dedicated IT shop to support FOIA. So I guess my question is, in connection to the resources, I mean, would OIP sort of be able to do something, so with say similar to OGE or something, where it provides desk officers or people that can sort of talk through the issues? I understand we can't create centralized products, but for example, to talk through maybe some of the IT issues, since we have a very, very small IT staff, and even our FOIA staff is just centralized within our general counsel's office. So people to help sort of talk through the issues as this rolls out.
We can certainly have meetings where people share ideas how they do it. You know, we can certainly facilitate that absolutely. I think, though, every agency posts, we've got to remember, every agency is posting material. Every agency has a web presence and is posting. By definition, every time you post, the people doing the posting are making sure your documents or your information is 508 compliant. So all we're doing here is saying, and remember the survey we took, 76 agencies, the FOIA offices did not have anything to do with the posting. So what we're saying is the FOIA offices are going to be, at least 76 of them, are going to be sending documents to their existing web teams to post for the public. So that's what we have to remember. It's 24, I mean, that's why we did the survey, to sort of see the lay of the land. I realize, though, that, and again, as chief FOIA officers who have higher overarching views of what's happening in their agency, sure, you can't just say to those, that poor IT office, well, guess what? Here's, you know, hundreds and thousands of pages that you just have to somehow absorb. We do need to address the resource issues there. We realize that, which is why we need the chief FOIA officer to take a look across the agency to see how can you do it and how much time do you think it would take to do it.
Thank you. Okay.
Do we have one more question? Okay. I know it's, believe me, we have heard for agencies, all the things that you guys are saying now are really, this is the very reason why we did the pilot. Because there has always been this this reaction of, oh dear, it's work, we're afraid it's going to slow down FOIA requests, you know, we're afraid it's going to be counterproductive, which is our greater goal. And that's the reason we did the pilot, to sort of see how does it actually work. And I think the terrific thing about the pilot was that the agencies that participated, it did work, and it didn't throw their FOIA offices into a total tizzy. They did manage to make it work, and they also are all like, we want to keep going with it, and we found these extra benefits from it. So I think what we have to do is I feel like you will get there. Let me put it that way. You can get there because our pilot participants got there, and I'm not expecting that everyone can just be ready. I'm not remotely expecting that everyone could go on January and say, okay, here we are. But I bet you that there will be many agencies who are going to tell me they can do it. They can do it all the way by January 1st. But certainly larger volume agencies, you know, of which DOJ is one, I certainly don't think we'll be ready to go all the way. We're going to need, I'm sure, a rolling process. So I think to be just what I'd like you to ask you to do is to see what can you do by January and how much time do you think it would take you to implement fully. Okay, and we will send you a template to kind of help you give us those answers that will help us also gather, compile the information. And then we also will be setting up the meeting for journalists to hear their concerns about the idea of building in some sort of delay. Okay? Yes, David.
I have two related questions, mm-hmm. both based on the fact that essentially FOIA requests come in randomly. Suppose
right.
you get a request for several items that are already on your website in different
uh-huh.
places.
Uh-huh.
Do you have to do anything? And the related
okay.
question is, whatever it is that the request is asking for,
uh-huh.
is there an obligation on the part of the agency when it releases to all
uh-huh.
to organize these things mm-hmm. to make them findable to
right.
someone else?
So the first question, the answer to the first question, of course, is that you just point the requester to the documents on the web page. Requester's happy, you're happy, everybody's happy. It's a golden moment in FOIA. You've already got it on your web page, absolutely. The organizing them. We did find as part of the pilot, this is another thing that I think that we will build time to do. Certainly it's, as I said at the beginning, for this to really be beneficial to the public and also to be beneficial to us as agencies, the more organized the records are, the more searchable they are, the better it will be. So that it's not just, if it's just a big morass of documents, nobody's going to look at them. But we want to try to help build in more search capability, find capability in the consolidated portal is another one of our big initiatives right now. I think right now, I feel the mood of the room, and I know how difficult this is. I don't want to say that, oh, we immediately think you've got to have organizing as well as posting. Let's take it in steps and get them posted first. And obviously, again, your web team can help figure out the best way to post. And then the idea can be we can improve quality as we go. That's my initial reaction. No one can have questions forever. I don't know. All right, we'll do two more. Are you all right? All right. I will stay and answer questions up here because I know this is a lot to absorb, and it really made our first council meeting have a really meaty ask to all of you, but I think we'll have a real tangible result at the other end of it, which is also really exciting. So thank you all. We will be in touch with the template. We will be in touch about the next meeting, and in the meantime, I just ask you to go back and think about how best you could do this, now that we have the direction from the president to do so. Thank you all.